Our chalice lighting this morning is from Joshua, chapter 24, verse 15. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. In our family, when someone sneezes, someone else calls out, "May the luck be with you." The person who sneezed responds by saying, "And also with you." Our four-year-old daughter, Kailani, is the most consistent in remembering this call and response, probably because she's heard it most of her life. Basal and I grew up with the usual bless you and thank you and the occasional gesundheit. So giving Kailani other words to say has required a conscious effort, and our chosen words don't always come easily for us. As an atheist, I gave up saying bless you a long time ago. But when Saul and I became parents, our daughter's tiny sneezes seemed to beg acknowledgement. And because I have been known to say I believe in luck rather than God, and because Saul is a lapsed Episcopal who remembers passing the peace every Sunday morning, our solution was this: may the luck be with you and also with you. I sometimes think we shouldn't limit this exchange to sneezes. Sharing a little luck seems warranted for many of life's moments, big and small. Heading off to work for the day, may the luck be with you, and also with you. Putting our daughter to bed, may the luck be with you, and also with you. Reflecting on your own theology, thinking about whom and what you worship, taking the God test, may the luck be with you, and also with you. Come, let us worship together. From Reverend Marilyn Sewell, in a very real sense, all theology is autobiography, is it not? Our experience, real and vicarious, is what informs our sense of reality, our internal picture of the way the world works, what our values are. We believe what we know is true. That is our felt knowledge, not what we are told is true. For Unitarian Universalists, the question is never, what do you believe? But rather, what kind of person have you become? What are the fruits of your living?
Please join me now in the spirit of prayer. Spirit of life, spirit of love, spirit of unfolding mystery, be with us today and every day as we struggle with difficult questions. Give us the answers we need, even if they aren't the answers we want. And forgive us when we fail to accept them gracefully. When we ask the wrong questions, lead us to more insightful ones. When we ask the right ones, help us to discern the truth. And with that truth, the strength to work miracles. Amen.
morning's reading is excerpted from an interview with Amy Tan, published as part of the Reader's Guide for her novel, Saving Fish from Drowning. I do not consider myself a religious person because I don't adhere to a particular religion or faith or prescribed beliefs, as did my father, who was a Baptist minister. And I'm not an atheist, one who thinks that a belief in anything beyond the here and the now and the rational is delusion. I love science, but I allow for mystery, things that can never be proven by a rational mind. I am a person who thinks about the nature of the spirit. I think about what can't be known and only imagined. I often sense a spirit or a force or a meaning beyond myself. I leave it open as to what the spirit is, but I continue to make guesses. That it could be the universal binding emotion of love, or a joyful quality of humanity, or a collective unconscious that turns out to be a unified conscious. The spirit could be all those worshipped by all the religions, even those that deny the validity of others. It could be that we exist in all 10 dimensions of a string theory universe and are seeding memories in all of them and occupy them simultaneously as memory. Or we exist only as thought, and our perception that it is a physical world is a delusion. Or maybe the nature of the spirit is a freer imagination. I've often thought that imagination was the conduit to compassion, and compassion is a true spiritual nature. Whatever the spirit might be, I am not basing what I do in this life on any expected reward or punishment in the hereafter or thereafter. It is enough that I feel blessed. And by whom or what, I don't know, but I receive it with gratitude that my work is to imagine all the possibilities.
I have a confession to make. And for those who know me, today's confession may come as a bit of a surprise. I no longer consider myself an atheist. No. My belief system hasn't undergone some radical shift. No, I haven't had a near-death experience. No, I haven't suddenly found religion. I found my religion a long time ago, right here in this church. This shift is a little more subtle. You might even say that this shift is mostly about semantics. Because for a long time now, I've been a little uncomfortable with some of the connotations the word atheist carries with it. One misconception that I sometimes encounter is the idea that because I don't believe in God, I must not believe in anything. Through either apathy or hostility or neglect, I have somehow failed to form any opinion whatsoever about the nature of existence, our place in the universe, or the human capacity for good and evil. I don't believe in God or heaven or Jesus Christ because I'm just too lazy or too busy to do so. And nothing could be further from the truth. I don't claim to be a scholar or a philosopher. I'm not particularly well-versed in the writings of Ralph Waldo Emerson or any of the other venerated deep thinkers of our tradition. But I have done a lot of thinking and a lot of questioning and even my share of preaching about the issues that I face in my day-to-day life, about my struggle to be a better person, and even about my sometimes complicated relationship with Jesus and his teachings. So yes, I think I have a pretty solid belief system, one that still has plenty of room for doubts and questions, One that doesn't mind being shaken and stirred once in a while. So let's do it. Let's shake things up a bit. From now on, whenever anyone asks, I'm not going to tell them I'm an atheist. Instead, I'm going to tell them I'm a non-theist. It means essentially the same thing, but it sounds more open-ended and thought-provoking. Maybe when someone hears it, they won't be so quick to make assumptions about what I believe or disbelieve. Maybe it'll even spark a discussion about how I respect and admire people with sincerely held religious beliefs, even if I don't share those beliefs. Maybe they won't automatically assume that the A in atheist stands for anti. Because that's the other misconception I sometimes run across, and the one that bothers me the most. The idea that because I am an atheist, I must be categorically opposed to religion or religious people or God. You can hardly blame people for this assumption. There are a lot of loud, angry atheists out there. Atheists who are outspoken in their opposition to anything that smacks of religion and aren't afraid to vent their rage to anyone who will listen, or failing that, on the internet. It's true, angry atheists exist. I just don't happen to be one of them. I don't hate religious people, and I certainly don't hate God, mostly because it's hard to hate something that I don't really believe in the first place. To be honest, I rather like the idea of God. The idea that someone, some super intelligent being somewhere, knows me, cares about me, and has a personal investment in my development as a person. Part of me really wants to believe in a God. I've just never met one that passed the test. Because to my mind, if you're going to worship a God, then the decision to worship has to be a conscious choice. If worship is mandatory, it's not really worship, right? And if I'm going to make a conscious decision to worship a God, I'm going to need to see some pretty convincing evidence that said God is worth worshiping. If I'm going to pour my whole self, my time, and my energy into actually worshiping something, that something's got to be, well, really something. And if my conscious choice is really going to mean anything, then I'm probably compelled to explore and compare my options. So let's go shopping, shall we? Now, as previously noted, I'm not a religious scholar, so this isn't going to be an exhaustive comparative religion lecture. Instead, I'll focus on my own spiritual journey. I was raised in the Episcopal Church, so obviously Christianity was my first and for a long time my only exposure to religious thought. I've often joked with my friends that the Episcopal experience can best be described as Catholicism light, you know, without all the guilt. But Episcopals do value pageantry. They still have the robes and the incense and the white collars and the big pointy hats. And services follow a very specific format, so you always know what to expect. As a family, we kneeled, sat, and stood at all the prescribed times and recited in unison the words printed in the Book of Common Prayer. I can still, with a little prompting, recite most of the Nicene Creed. For several years, I donned robes myself and served as an acolyte, lighting candles, leading processions. I liked it. I liked lighting and extinguishing the candles, not just quickly and safely, but with a sense of ceremony and reverence. I liked feeling that I was contributing to something bigger than myself. But as I grew older and started actually paying attention to the words I was saying in church, I started to feel a little detached from the whole religious experience. I still felt resonance with some of Jesus' teachings, and I still appreciated the pageantry, but I wasn't feeling a lot of personal connection to God. God just wasn't speaking to me the way he seemed to be speaking to everyone else. And it was also starting to dawn on me that Christianity wasn't the only way of thinking about things. Like a lot of us, I was first exposed to Greek mythology in grade school. Many of their names are probably familiar to you, even if you weren't as fascinated by their stories as I was. Ares, the god of war, Poseidon, god of the sea, Aphrodite, goddess of love, Athena, goddess of wisdom. The Greeks had not just one, but a whole slew of gods, representing many different aspects of human existence. And the Greeks knew how to tell a good story. Each god had their own stories, usually full of adventure and sex and heroism and intrigue. These sounded like gods worthy of being worshipped, if only they weren't so misogynistic and self-absorbed. Still, I was fascinated, and I wasn't alone. Greek and Roman myths went on to inspire poets and playwrights, painters and sculptors, scientists and scholars for thousands of years after the fall of the Roman Empire. And eventually, they inspired this book. Deities and Demigods was a reference book published in 1980 by TSR Incorporated in support of their wildly popular role-playing game, Dungeons & Dragons. Okay, wildly popular might be pushing the limits of credulity. But among the geek crowd that I ran with back in high school, this book was cool. In addition to the Greek pantheon, it featured a whole bunch of other gods from sources, both fictional and historical. It had all the heavy hitters you might expect. The Norse gods included Thor, Odin, and Loki. The Egyptian gods had Ra, Set, and Anubis. But it also featured gods from more obscure sources. More obscure to me, anyway. Gods from Chinese, Babylonian, Celtic, Hindu, and Native American traditions were all found within its pages. I pored over that book for hours. And not just because many of the goddesses were scantily clad. I loved learning about how and what people from other places and other times worshipped. I loved thinking about how these different gods interacted with the physical world, with the forces they governed, with their devoted followers, and with each other. I also loved the division of labor present in all these diverse pantheons. One god didn't have to be all things to all people. Each god had his or her own distinct portfolio. Apollo was the god of light, healing, and music. Isis was the goddess of magic and fertility. Dionysus was the god of wine, festivals, and madness. Loki was the god of mischief, strife, and fire. Each was the ultimate arbiter in his or her specific field of expertise. Babylonian warriors could pray to Ishtar for success in battle. Chinese farmers who hoped for rain could make offerings to Qi Sun Tzu. And players who wanted to role play a religious character had to choose which god they were going to pay homage to and devote their life to. That choice was important because it was an important part of your character's backstory, and it informed all of your character's other in-game decisions. Of course, fantasy role-playing is inherently fictional. These characters, these gods, weren't real. And contrary to what you may have heard, Dungeons & Dragons had not stripped me of my ability to discern fantasy from reality. In the 80s, a lot of people were getting worried about Dungeons & Dragons and the supposed effect it was having on kids, teaching them to practice witchcraft, worship demons, etc. Almost all of this was silly, fear-mongering stuff. But they were right about one thing. D&D was giving me lots of ideas. And the more I thought about it, the more ideas I started to have about my own religious upbringing. And ideas can be dangerous. The disparity between religion as represented in this fantasy world of Dungeons and Dragons and my own experience with modern religious practice was becoming apparent to me. The gods represented in this book interacted with the mortal world in a very real, very measurable way. They spoke, they took on physical form, they answered prayers, they set concrete, achievable goals. And when things got hairy, they intervened on their followers' behalf. These were gods worthy of being worshipped, but they were fictional. And it didn't take a huge leap of logic to acknowledge the possibility that the god they talked about at my church, the god my parents and classmates and all my friends believed in, might just be fictional too. These ideas existed mostly on a subconscious level because I was still too young and too confused to ask the really tough questions I needed to about my own beliefs. I was scared to rock the boat too much, scared of disappointing my parents, scared of being ostracized, scared of people thinking I was a bad person, scared of actually being a bad person. Eventually, my fear of being disingenuous won out over my fear of social damnation. And you know what? It wasn't that bad. In the car one Sunday morning on the way to church, I told my parents that I didn't want to go to church because I didn't believe what everyone else there believed. And saying I did made me feel like a hypocrite. I'm not sure what I expected them to do. Standing here 30 years later, I can't with any certainty tell you exactly what they said in response, or even whether they still insisted I go to church that day. What I can tell you is that they didn't ostracize me. They didn't yell at me. They didn't do or say any of the hurtful things one might imagine. Most importantly, they didn't love me any less, which I suppose explains why they're here today, sitting right up here, listening to me as if I have something to value to say. But of course, my spiritual journey didn't end that day in the car. I'd taken a first step, but simple disbelief by itself wasn't very satisfying to me. I still wanted to believe in something, something concrete, something bigger than myself. So I kept searching. And I kept playing Dungeons and Dragons, or something very close to it. The game I play now is called Pathfinder. And every 2 weeks, my friends and I gather in my basement to swing swords, cast spells, solve puzzles, and kill stuff. Once in a while, we might even right an injustice or undertake an epic quest. But mostly what we do is tell stories together. It's a lot of fun. And of course, Pathfinder has its very own pantheon of gods. Pages and pages of them. There's Abadar, god of merchants, wealth, and law. He's a real stand-up guy. And Desna, goddess of dreams, travelers, and stars. She's pretty far out. And say what you want about Galander, god of parasites, disease, and corruption. But he's a lot of fun to tell stories about. Largely because when his followers show up, we don't have to spend a lot of time wondering what their motivations are. Their choice of deities makes their priorities pretty clear. If only things were so simple in real life. If only we had a whole pantheon of gods to choose from. If only we could choose who and what we worship and let that choice speak to others of our intentions. And of course, we do have that choice. Whether we believe in a higher power or not, every day we make choices. Think about it. What do you spend most of your time and energy on? When you have difficult choices to make, how do you prioritize? Because even if we don't attribute those choices to the influence of divine beings, we still pay tribute to the higher concepts those beings represent. With our time and energy, we worship at the altar of family, hard work, and community. With our actions and with our money, we make offerings to the gods of coffee, organic foods, and Facebook. With our words, we utter little prayers to the gods of music, gratitude, and racial equality. We have no shortage of gods. They're all around us, and they're begging for our attention. So with all this competition, how does the Christian God stack up? Does he pass the test? He's got a lot going for him if you look at the numbers. Even though his stats have been dropping steadily in recent years, his followers are still in the majority in this country. He provides a strong moral code to live by, And if you focus on the actual teachings of his appointed avatar, Jesus, rather than the teachings of some religious conservatives, he delivers a pretty effective message of hope and redemption. It's been a long time since I considered myself a Christian, but I think that the things I learned in Sunday school still have value. Jesus had a lot of good stuff to say about the way we ought to treat each other. In fact, if I had to pin Jesus down to a specific portfolio, I'd probably go with love, compassion, and sacrifice. And of course, he's got a pretty compelling story. It's been touted as the greatest story ever told. That sounds like hyperbole to me, but it's still a pretty good read. So where does he fall short? For me, it was that feeling of personal connection. When push came to shove, I just couldn't make it work when the relationship felt so one-sided. And ultimately, if we want to truly worship, we've got to make the relationship work. So my question for all of you is this. If you could invent a God for yourself, a God you considered worth worshiping, what qualities would you give them? What would a you God look like? What would they have in their portfolio? If you're stuck, there's a pretty good starting place right in front of you. If you look in your order of service on the left-hand side, about halfway down the page, at the covenant we read earlier, you'll see some of the words in that covenant are capitalized. Love, service, peace, truth. Those are some pretty powerful concepts. Right there in the promise we make to each other every time we gather together. Imagine what the God of love, service, peace, and truth looks like. Imagine her worshipers. What do they look like? On the front page of our church's website, there is a link to a promotional video for the Standing on the Side of Love campaign. The title of that YouTube video is We Are the Love People. It says it right there. We are the love people. And it's true. It's one of the values we hold most dear. If that's not part of our God's portfolio, I don't know what is. And if love is our primary message, are we doing everything we can to live up to it? Because truly honoring and worshiping the God of love is more than wearing an orange t-shirt to a rally, more than just reciting the word once a week at church. It means committing our time and our effort, our very lives, to that ideal. And that's the real test, the test that matters. The question isn't, is my God worth worshiping? Or what does my God stand for? Or does my God have a compelling story? It's what am I doing today, this week, in my life to live up to the ideals of my God? What do I stand for? What's my story? And is the story I'm telling with my daily actions the kind of story I want to tell? I've occasionally asked myself these questions, and I'm not always thrilled with the answers. I'd like to stand up here and tell you that my God is the God of love, family, and good customer service. But honestly, I probably spend as much time, if not more, worshiping the God of video games, self-righteousness, and cable TV. So this non-theist has got some work to do to live up to his own chosen ideals. And I can start by recognizing that the God the Christians worship, the God that I grew up with, the God that stands for love, compassion, and sacrifice, is still my God. Because he's part of who I am. He's part of my experience. He may go by a different name or no name at all. The words I recite at church may have changed. The pageantry may be different, but the message is still there. As our friends at the United Church of Christ are fond of saying, God is still speaking. It just may not sound like we expect it to sound. Regardless of what some people will tell you, we live in a polytheistic world. Whether we admit it or not, we all have more than one God, more than one set of ideals that command our hearts and minds at any given moment. What's important is the balance of power in your particular pantheon. One of the best things religion has to offer people, in my opinion, is a sense of purpose, a feeling that there is meaning in the universe and that your actions, your very existence, is an important part of that meaning. If you've ever found yourself floundering or lacking in purpose, maybe it's time to reevaluate your pantheon. So go, choose your gods, make them good ones, ones that you can be proud of, ones that are worthy of your worship. And once you've chosen your God, put yourself to the test. Do you stand for the things you want to stand for? If not, maybe it's time for a change. Maybe there's something you're doing or not doing that doesn't align with your God's central message. If so, change it. Every day is a chance to make new choices about the things we choose to worship. So make your choices count.
Ours is an interfaith marriage. Saul is a non-theist. I remain an atheist. As interfaith marriages go, we're pretty compatible. Some might say that's a blessing. I usually say we're pretty lucky. Lucky we can write and lead these services together. And lucky for me, he almost always lets me have the last word. As we prepared for this service, Saul asked me to think about the portfolio of my God, about myself as a worshiper. Not easy requests for me to fulfill as an atheist, even as a Unitarian Universalist. But I should have known the portfolio he was going to share today: love, service, peace, truth. These are the messages Kailani hears day in and day out, even as we struggle to live up to them. We believe in peace, Mama. Love is what our family does, Mama. We keep our promises, Mama. We don't lie, Mama. That's right, I say. Recently, Kailani and I came home, and I realized I didn't have a key to get inside our house. Saul would be coming home soon, but not for at least another hour, maybe two. I didn't have my cell phone. Our dear friend Kat, who has a key, wasn't home. And my in-laws were with Saul. So as Kailani and I waited on the porch swing for Saul's return, we chatted about this problem. She thought not having a key to get inside was probably the biggest problem she'd ever faced. When I asked her what other big problems she'd encountered, she thought for a bit and decided this was the only biggest problem. I didn't agree with her, but I didn't think I needed to argue the point at the time. She spent most of the time coming up with potential solutions, one of which involved sending her dad a postcard to alert him to the problem. I was eager to tell Saul about the problem-solving Kailani did as we waited, and I enjoyed telling the story of Kailani's biggest problem to our friends. I also had fun sharing it with all of you. I teach a Building Family Strengths class, and in that class, I talk about the importance of storytelling. I tell my students, storytelling lives at the heart of human experience. Careful listeners come to see people's lives as stories. So as I thought about Saul's requests, I realized the God I worship is story. And I worship by listening to stories and telling stories. And isn't that how most of us worship across religions? We listen to stories, we tell stories. If serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourself this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods of your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord of love, of peace, of service, of truth, of story. Amen. As we leave today, we repeat the words of Reverend Marilyn Sewell. What kind of person have you become? What are the fruits of your living? And as you ponder your answers, we say to you, may the luck be with you, and your responses, and also with you. Go in peace.